From his early beginnings in the band Beatnik Beach, followed by the success and cult following with his power pop band Jellyfish in the early 90s, Roger Joseph Manning Jr. continues to explore and create music that contains musical excellence and well-crafted lyrics. The past three decades have been filled with a variety of projects for Roger, from Imperial Drag to TVIs to several solo and collaborative projects, not to mention lending his talents to artists like Beck, Jay-Z, Blink-182, and the legendary Johnny Cash. Manning's latest project reunites two of his past Jellyfish bandmates to form the Licorice Quartet. The power pop trio has just released their first four-song EP titled Threesome Volume 1, which was released on May 15th and carries on the incredible musicianship and songwriting vibe that Jellyfish fans have grown accustomed to. Inside Music Cast is pleased to welcome Roger Joseph Manning Jr. Hey Roger, welcome.
Hey there, good to be here, Rick.
You know, we're really glad to have you on the show, and our focus today will be, you know, primarily on the new EP from your new band, The Licorice Quartet, and we'll chat more about it shortly. But to start things off, and, you know, it's sort of a bittersweet time to release, you know, music. We've interviewed a lot of other musicians who have been releasing new music in this interesting time that we're all experiencing. And, you know, at the same time, though, what a blessing for fans of yours to get to experience, you know, new music in such a, you know, grim atmosphere that we're all facing. So I'm just curious, just to start off, you know, how has the lockdown affected you so far, or has it?
Well, thankfully, it's affected my day-to-day very little because I'm a freelance musician, and so I often work a lot from home anyway. So I just kind of kept working. Now, the only thing that is missing is each year there is a period of that year that I joined Beck for touring, and he, of course, had a bunch of summer stuff set up in Europe and so forth, so obviously that got canceled along with everybody else's touring plans. So it's just invited more focus at home, getting deeper into, I mean, frankly, in between projects for other people, future solo recordings and finalizing future Licorice Quartet EPs, et cetera.
Yeah, good. We're finding the same thing from a lot of our guests that, you know, they're just busy. You know, if they're studio bums or whatever, and half of their career is in their studio, then that's amazing. But you know what? A lot of artists don't have that option sometimes.
Yeah, although those are becoming fewer and fewer. I mean, it's there's, you know, teenagers making incredible sounding recordings out of their basement on their laptop.
Hey, we understand that when you were growing up, you know, you had a pretty eclectic taste in music, and which included even ragtime. So you took piano lessons and you learned how to play the drums. And then, you know, it goes without saying that British pop was a heavy influence to your taste. But tell us more about how you were inspired musically, and when did you know that music was going to be your career path?
You know, I grew up with top 40 radio like anybody in the suburbs, and it wasn't until my junior high school years that some of the older kids turned me on to all kinds of music that, I mean, it was an endless world of stuff that wasn't on the radio.
Right, that's
stuff,
true.
You know,
true,
stuff that wasn't shoved down your throat.
Yeah.
And that just opened up so many worlds for me. I have fond memories of saving $10 to $20 during the week, and then on Saturday my friends and I would spend some of that money getting the bus and the BART tram in the Bay Area, where I grew up in San Francisco area, into Berkeley, where they literally had upwards of five or six used record stores all within walking distance. And 50-cent dollar vinyl was just everywhere. Yeah. So we'd each come home with about 20 records. And because they were so cheap, there was an attitude of, there was no risk, because even if you didn't like the record, oh, well, you just paid a dollar for it. But between the three of us, we'd come home with, you know, 60, 75 albums, and we just tape each other's records. So feeding frenzy.
I remember.
Yeah, it was a feeding frenzy of everything and anything. And we got very much into, we found that if there were players that we liked, guitarists, keyboard players, drummers, it didn't matter, we would discover other albums that they played on. Some were jazzy, some were fusion, some were rock, some were straight up pop. A lot of them had a lot of skill sets, and that's how we got introduced to different music. And we figured, well, if these players are playing on them, there must be some level of sophistication that's fascinating to us, be it in their performing abilities or improvisational skills, some of the crazy soundscapes with synthesizers and drum machines that were happening in the late 70s, early 80s. So it was just, I mean, we couldn't get enough of it. So needless to say, although we had our preferences, we had this philosophy that if it was quality, if it was good, if it was strong writing, strong production, we didn't care if it was punk or pop or bebop or fusion or new wave or whatever. I mean, it just like it all had that integrity. And that's what set it apart from all the fluff that was being thrown at us, you know, on MTV or Top 40 Radio, all the usual avenues. And some of that was fine too, but often we found that just looking right beneath the surface of that is where all the really amazing, awe-inspiring stuff was. So it was in high school that I just couldn't get enough of this, and I was like, well, why do I ever want to be without this drug? And the more I practiced, the more it gave back to me. So I couldn't even imagine a life that didn't have some kind of music component to it. And somewhere along the way, I was kind of like, well, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but if all these people have done it in the last three decades, then I should be able to figure out my version. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. But so I kept just following everything that I liked. Whatever turned me on is what I would pursue further.
You know, and speaking of bands that were influential, and it's a favorite band of mine is XTC. And in fact, you know, the album Oranges and Lemons and Skylarking are two of my very favorite records in general. And, you know, Andy Partridge, you know, he's just a brilliant songwriter. And from what I understand, their music weighed pretty heavy on you, too. And just tell us what you took away from XTC that played a role in how you write your own songs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I had to, you know, list, okay, here are the five artist bands that songwriters that have inspired me, certainly in my songwriting and what I look for in my pop rock fare, whatever you want to label it. I mean, Andy and Colin are right up there at the tippy top. They have been for years. And what they showed me, I mean, you know, they're another band that because their career is so long, they went through so many explorations of different kind of pop stylings. I pretty much like their entire catalog for one reason or another, but for some reason, the Drums and Wires, Black Sea, English Settlement era is my favorite, and it's my deepest, and that's the era that hit me first. Well, I got turned on to them when in the middle of that era, in my early high school years. And for me, I love the, you know, he's quite a gaming enthusiast, but not in the terms of video games, but just like old board games and things that he grew up with, and he likes the kind of jigsaw puzzle, creating a maze. You know, I've written myself into a corner. How do I get out? That's one of the joys of songwriting. he has incredible standards, which were very clear to me early on. You know, people like him and Elvis Costello and Joe Jackson, they were all peers. And that's because they were all children of the 50s who grew up as teenagers in the 60s. So the super, super colorful, experimental, but still very catchy, hooky arrangements of a lot of 60s psych pop are in the blood of all those people. You know, Susie and the Banshees, Blondie, a lot of our great new wave, kind of goth, neo-psych music of the late 70s, early 80s. Those are all kids who grew up in the 60s, worshiping Syd Barrett and all the obvious key players, particularly if you're from England, so you're inspired by Pretty Things and Small Faces and The Creation, and a lot of bands didn't have the success in the States, but that whole psych pop thing was a very, very big influence, so I very much resonated with it. So when I was hearing a lot of Black Sea, it just showed me you could do so much in 3.5 minutes. You could transport the listener to a completely different environment if you did it right. Certainly lyrically, but what mood you created with the melody and the harmony of the chords and stuff, and the rhythms. And you know, we're talking about bands that set out to do it with just guitar, bass, drums. Occasionally there was a little bit of keyboards, but even as a the prog that I enjoy, be it Genesis and Yes, all the obvious players, you know, that's all done with guitar, drums, bass, keyboards, and singing. Yeah. And it's the same instruments as the Damned. It's the same instruments as Cheap Trick. But right. Everybody does it a little different. And that's what fascinated me. Why were some bands pushing my buttons to such a degree that I couldn't stop listening to them? You know, Todd Rundgren's another one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just spend hours transcribing what they were doing, just like I did with jazz people when I was fascinated with. I went through a big jazz phase, and I still love jazz, but there was a time when I was learning everybody's jazz stuff. Well, I did that with all my favorite pop stuff, past and present. And you just decode, you're like, oh, here's this guy's bag of tricks. Oh, here's Eric Stewart and Graham Goldman from 10cc's bag of tricks. And ideally, when you start writing your own stuff, you're just cherry-picking from all your favorite bags of tricks.
Right.
And you keep doing it, and you keep doing it, and you keep doing it, until finally you're like, all right, I seem to be creating a semblance of some original sound here. And that's, you know, you kind of know when you've done that and you start. I mean, I could play you demos of all my first songs that I was at least proud of. I threw piles of them away. I was like, this is terrible. This is shit. This isn't worthy of playing for anybody. I hate it, blah, blah, blah. That went on for years. And I finally started creating some songs I liked. Yeah. If I played all those for you, you'd go, oh, you're just trying to copy XTC. Yeah, exactly. Because I was still learning what they were doing and how, and it was the only thing I was eating, so it was the only thing that was coming back out.
Sure.
And
that's interesting.
It would be years again before original thoughts would come out that I said, you know what, this has all the ingredients that I like, the very kind of hooky sing-along stuff, the harmony accompaniment and the vocals, these melodic counterpoint things with the instruments and a groove and a feel, and the lyrics seems to tie it all together, but I don't think I'm ripping anybody off. And if I am, somebody please tell me. And that's, you know, that starts happening somewhere around, right around the Jellyfish era.
Yeah.
A lot of my songs that I felt could stand on their own, mm-hmm. and certainly collaborations with my partner, Andy, at the time.
Yeah. Well, that actually segues perfectly into my next question. And, you know, many of our listeners know you from the band Jellyfish, of course. And in fact, that band still has a really hardcore following. And we won't spend a ton of time talking about Jellyfish, but I know so many friends and musicians alike who really, you know, herald those two albums you released back in the 90s as really influential and instant classics, you know, Billy Button and Spilt Milk. And you and your co-founder, Andy Sturmer, parted ways after those two albums. And I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but this was something that our friend Paul Bluebaugh wanted me to ask. But have you ever discussed a reunion of some sort with Andy?
No. I mean, certainly people have talked about it, but it's been more business people.
Yeah, yeah.
Various projects have come up over the years that brought me together with some former bandmates, certainly Licorice Quartet's one of them.
Yeah.
But when Andy and I parted ways, it was pretty much, you know, it was because primarily of musical direction differences and you know, just kind of basically getting a divorce. I mean, we'd
been
in marriage for many years and was kind of like, all right, I think I need to take a break. And so that's what we did. And then it was kind of like, well, that was a chapter in my life, and
mm-hmm.
there was I never felt an urge to reopen that. Thankfully, there were so many other explorations that were going to take place on my own and with other collaborators in the years that followed. So that's kind of the boring, succinct story there.
Okay. All right. Well, no, that's all right. I just wanted to ask that. I know it's been a long time since that all went down, so I thought, well, maybe over the course of the past couple decades, you mm-hmm. know, something would have happened, but let's dive in and talk about the Licorice Quartet. And this is a brand new group that you've created. You released your first EP titled Threesome Volume 1 this past Friday, May 15th, that contains four really amazing tracks. And the band consists of past Jellyfish bandmates, bassist Tim Smith and guitarist Eric Dover, and of course yourself on key. So tell us in a nutshell how you came together to form this new trio.
Well, around 2017, I had been listening to Tim's old project Umajets that Eric and I had briefly played on and done some work for him way back in the mid-90s.
Okay.
And just feeling nostalgic that all this time had gone by at 1,000 miles an hour and we never really had written or done any of that to the degree that I know at one point we had wanted to. So it was just a conversation with Tim about riding long distance for old time's sake and seeing what came of it. He was super into it. And then we talked again. He said, "Hey, is there any reason we shouldn't invite Eric along?" You know, "No, let's do that." You know, Tim and Eric had always been very strong singer-songwriters in their own right. In fact, you know, given my preference, I would have had them have songs on a future Jellyfish record that never materialized. But we never got a chance to, conduct that experiment.
Okay.
So we were many ways picking up the pieces we left off there all those years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just turned into several writing sessions. Tim would fly out, which slowed things down since he lives in Atlanta. And that turned into, "All right, you think you want to record these, or how are we going to do that? That costs money, blah, blah, blah."
Yeah.
Anyway, it turned into 3 years, 2.5 years of piecemealing this album together.
Okay.
So we've recorded 12 songs.
That's right.
The other eight are near completion. They still have some work, but they're close to being ready to go. When we just picked these four, we thought they made a good first outing for the fans. Let's put our foot forward, or some foot forward, and get this machine rolling. The fans have been unbelievably dedicated and committed, mm-hmm. even when there's been radio silence from us over the years. And I knew they were out there. They were certainly supportive during my Glamping EP, which came out in 2018 mm-hmm. on Pledge Music. So that's why this is happening as it is. And the goal is to not disappear for 5 years, but to have music more consistently for them.
No, that's great.
Yeah. Hey, Roger, Paul Blueball has another question. He says that this collaboration involves, obviously, three of four of the band members that were on the Jellyfish's Spilt Milk tour. So he wants to know, out of curiosity, was there any interest in having Jason Faulkner involved in this project at all? And the second part is, who was playing drums on the project, Jeremy, Stacy?
Correct. So we're all mutual friends with Jeremy, Stacy. He was an obvious choice for us, but being in England, we didn't know if he'd be available or interested or mm-hmm. we could afford him or any of that stuff. And without boring you with the details, it all worked out. So that was an incredible asset and dream come true. Whether you're talking about Andy or my brother Chris or Jason, all mm-hmm. of whom are former Jellyfish members, we didn't get together with the intention of reuniting Jellyfish. It was, let's get together and see what the sound the three of us create.
Okay, gotcha.
I mean, it was challenging enough having three independent voices being able to unify. Making records by democratic vote can be a tedious and sometimes not yielding the best results as opposed to one singular focus.
Right.
But we managed to do it. That was the challenge. So, I mean, there was no shortage of ideas. I mean, I just think it never occurred to any of us, well, we're doing just fine. There's already too many cooks in the kitchen. So it never, ever came up. And we just kept motoring along.
Hey, you know, the band name, the Licorice Quartet, is pretty unique unto itself, and it kind of reminded us of how, you know, Steely Dan decided on their name. And, you know, yours comes from an Italian erotic film released in 1970, and that said, tell us a little more about how this became the name of the band.
I certainly knew the film of Radley Metzger. Mm-hmm. They were kind of reintroduced to the public, along with a lot of those incredible Italian score soundtracks mm-hmm. in the mid to late 90s, and that movie was, you know, one of my favorite, and I'd forgotten all about it. I hadn't even seen it for years, and when you start getting in name mode, you just start excavating. There's no wrong answers, I just threw it out one day. I mean, for me, it conjures up all kinds of incredible imagery, but I just thought it made a great name, too, for people who have no idea.
Right.
So the film is fairly obscure.
Oh, yeah.
You can go online and find it in 2 seconds, but it's not. Our music doesn't have anything to do with the film or the aesthetic of the film. It's really just about enjoying the name.
Well, I got to admit that when I started, you know, hitting up the Licorice Quartet on Google, that pops up first, and I thought, wait a second, is this where the band got their name? So then I started, you know, Googling more, and then I, you know, discovered that that's how you got the name. So that was pretty interesting. Hey, on that same vibe, though, one of the tracks on the EP, the first track on the EP is titled Fadoodle, which was written by your bandmate Eric Dover. And the song is an up-tempo, you know, power pop tune that was inspired by, I guess, a list of naughty words that he found from back in the day for, you know, what people used to denote fornication, along with, you know, wanting to find new ways of saying dirty things. So tell us more about this track.
Yeah, so just a little sidebar. So one of the joys of this project is that there is no one lead singer or one lyricist or one songwriter. We literally kind of Crosby, Stills, and Nash all this stuff.
That's cool.
So Fadoodle was actually a musical idea that started for me. I had no lyrics. I had a couple chunks that you hear of verse and chorus. Me and the guys finished off the music, but yeah, Eric absolutely ran with the vocal idea, which is always super important. I write lyrics. I enjoy doing that, but I'm very slow about it. So often my lyrics will come post music, but Eric got those lyrics in there pretty early, so we had a concept, which is great, and the music then kind of played off of that. But I think that was just him. He's really good at looking under all kinds of rocks for subject matter that's off the beaten path and not just your average trite Moon in June fare. What can I say? I loved all the playfulness and tongue-in-cheek and sense of humor. Patting ourselves on the back, but it's very much something that is in the Sparks lexicon. And those guys are just endless influences for me and certainly Eric. So can't have enough of them in our life. And again, at the end of the day, it doesn't sound entirely like them, but it certainly has that spirit.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, Roger, I've got a question. You know, when it comes down to, you know, your music and your breadth, your catalog from Jellyfish to solo projects and, of course, Licorice now, the element that really comes forward are your vocal harmonies. You know, you do a really, really great job. They're silky. They're electric. You know, and, we can see that you spent an awful lot of time mixing them and devoted an awful lot of time to these vocals. Talk to us about that, would you?
Well, yes, for better or for worse, it's just one of the things I love about most of my pop heroes and a certain era of record production. They're sensational. They sound superhuman. They sound special and can really help create moods instantly. And yet they're not computerized. There's a huge organic, natural human.
Right.
It kind of furthers the human interface. Sometimes when you hear drums and guitar and certainly a lot of electronic keyboards and things, you forget that there's like organic humans making this music and not robots. And of course, robots are to a degree now with computers. In fact, there's plenty of music that's entirely robot generated, and that's part of why it's appreciated. And I have no problem with that. I've certainly done my share of it, but there's no denying when you've got people who know how to harmonize and sing and blend together, especially when you see groups doing that live. I mean, it's a lost art. There's very few groups doing three, four-part harmony, again, as almost every band did in the 60s. I mean, you got kicked out of the group if you didn't know how to do three-part basic harmony.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Because that's just, you're jamming in the garage. It's like, you want to impress the girls. Well, you better know how to sing the fifth above your lead singer on the fly and do it well. And you had no shortage of teachers. Every record had some version of that on it, unless you were Bob Dylan. that's just a tradition I've enjoyed carrying on. I love doing my version of it, and then when I team up with these other people, we create another version of it. But it requires great, great patience. It's super, super time consuming, no matter how good the singers are. There's a myriad of ways to physically record them in the studio to get different effects. And those all take time. So it's just like this, what can I say? The whole reason I deal with all the chore of creating them is because I love the payoff.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, one of the songs on the new EP that demonstrates these incredible vocal harmonies is my personal favorite. It's Bluebird's Blues. And this song is intoxicating me, and I have no offense to the other tracks, but I had a hard time not listening to this one, and I kept hitting repeat. And the opening of the track, you know, kind of has that nod to 10cc, which you mentioned a little while ago, with that angelic sort of choral swell with a hint of 60s Beatles hovering over a lot of the track. That's just a really magical track on the album for me. It's a personal favorite. I just wanted to let you know that I love that.
Thank
one.
You. Great, thank you.
Well, hey, Roger, Eddie, let's pause for a second and let's play a clip of this track, Bluebird's Blues. And this is from our guest today, Roger Joseph Manning Jr. and his band, The Licorice Quartet, on Inside MusicCast. I know we're out of time, but I just wanted to thank you for joining us here on Inside MusicCast, and I wanted to let everybody know that this EP is available now. And I just wanted to ask you real quick, I know it's available in digital formats for download and for streaming and all of that, but are you going to create any vinyl or CDs, any kind of physical format that fans can grab?
No, there's absolutely both. Yeah.
Great.
And it's not, it's yeah, there. You can go to our website, LicoriceQuartet.com, mm-hmm. and just go to the shop button, and that's where everything pops up. So not only do you see CD and vinyl options, there's signed versions, all kinds of T-shirts and posters and fun things like that. But more importantly, and I really want to encourage listeners to check this out, are the fan experiences, which I started doing for my pledge campaign with the solo EP in 2018 called Glamping, which I'm going to be re-releasing that actually later this year. But
Great. For
now, there's all kinds of experiences. So it's literally things like go record shopping with a band member or interview the band member over the phone or Skype or interview all of us over Skype as a group or Zoom or we'll, you know, co-write a song with you. We'll play on your pet project. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Obviously, there's different price points. Certain experiences are kind of quick and easy and don't take too long, and others are more involved. But if somebody wants to go that deep, we offer it. And it's just been a really pleasant surprise to see people so excited to engage in this way. It really makes the whole thing one step beyond, you know, the joy of listening to the music. And it's just been so great to have somebody want to interview you from Japan or England or FaceTime with you in Germany or, you know, people in Canada who's like, hey, I've got two songs. Will you play some keyboards?
Yeah.
Hey, Tim, I've got two songs. Will you sing some background vocals?
Yeah.
Whatever it is. So, you know, have at it.
Well, we appreciate your time. We know you've got to get to another project, but maybe sometime we can have you back on the show because there's a lot of things we skipped over, you know, from your career, from your solo albums to some of the other projects you've worked on, from your experiences with Brian Wilson and Ringo Starr and Johnny Cash and Beck. I mean, there's a lot of things we didn't cover, but we really wanted to talk about Licorice Quartet today, and it's a great EP, and I advise everybody to go pick it up. And thanks for joining us today, Roger.
Oh, thank you so much. And please feel free to reach out to me and, you know, we can set up another podcast to get all your other questions answered.
Sure.
It's a real joy to connect with the audience this way. And I've had a lot of fun doing interviews for YouTube channels and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They just go really, really well.
Yeah. Well, again, this is a great EP. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay. Thank you, Rick.
All right. Take care.
Special thanks to Roger Joseph Manning Jr. for joining us on this episode of Inside MusicCast. Inside MusicCast is a collaborative effort of music lovers worldwide, and our team includes Brian Pearson in Chicago, Kim Riley in South Florida, Scott Gross in Tampa, Mikhail Engstrom in Stockholm, Sweden, Scott Sheriff in Nashville, Don Brightup in Los Angeles, Loretta Sassaman in Seattle, Yinka Oyelese in New Jersey, and Arnaud Legere in Paris, France. Be sure to check out our newly rebranded Inside MusicCast website that includes a fresh look, guest search options, a new podcast audio player, downloadable episodes, Inside MusicCast Radio, and our new studio tours feature with photos and information about some of our guest studios, workspaces, and gear. Find it all at InsideMusicCast.com. Inside MusicCast is powered by Earshot Audio Post and Cabello Associates. For Eddie Cabello, I'm Rick Such. Thanks for your support of Inside MusicCast.